Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. It's called Assisted Suicide, Death with Dignity, or even The Right to Die. Whatever the label, nearly 20% of Americans now live in places where it's legal. Washington, D.C. is one of those places. Should Maryland be? Plus, chimeras. They're part animal and part human, and they're being grown in scientific labs. They could lead to new cures. But at what cost? Today, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, joins me to discuss the dilemmas that dying patients, their families, and doctors face, and the ethical cost of chimeras. Wrestling with the complex questions of bioethics, coming up on this edition of Midday. First, the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you've decided to join us for Midday here on WYPR. In 2016, 8 new states made it legal to seek assistance if you want to end your life. That brings the total number of states who have so-called death with dignity laws to 12, if I'm counting correctly. Oregon's law, the first in the country, is now 20 years old. So what have we learned from the experience in Oregon? How has that experience informed the support of similar laws in other places? Have the moral and ethical dilemmas that patients and their families and their physicians face evolved the way that clearly Americans are evolving on this complex issue? Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He stops by Midday from time to time to talk about how ethicists help us frame the questions that we need to ask when we are confronted with sticky wickets like these. Jeff, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Always like having you come over and unstick our wickets, you know. So assisted suicide, there's even controversy about what to call it, the right to die, death with dignity. How should we refer to this?
It's a good question, and I prefer actually a fourth option, which is aid in dying. So a little bit of the answer comes from what the movement, the people who are advocating for the actions or the right, call it themselves. And at the moment, it's physician aid in dying is the term of art. But it's, as you rightly pointed out, it started really as physician-assisted suicide, although that connotes a certain kind of decision, so taking one's life before your time, since what suicide tends to connote for many people, versus a process that's already well underway that you are merely helping along because it's too difficult to continue under the current your current symptoms and there isn't any going back.
And of course, physician-assisted suicide for many years had a face. It was Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who was nicknamed Dr. Death by all sorts of people. And so the branding of it really is important, and it's significant, at least in how it shapes public opinion. But has public opinion been changing? I mean, now just in the November election alone, 6 states voted by fairly big margins to make it allowable, legal in those places, in Colorado and places like that.
California would be the in a way the most important state because it's so large, and what happens in public policy in California tends to be a harbinger for how many other parts of the country will.
They had passed it in June,
correct?
So it's already been 6 months for them, and it's just been a few months for Colorado.
So in this last year, this last round, I guess, of states. So to go back to your point about Dr. Kevorkian, which is a good one. A kind of unfortunate case, frankly. So Dr. Kevorkian pushed very hard at a time when the public wasn't really ready. The medical profession wasn't ready. And he wasn't a good spokesperson, I think, for what turned out to be a cause that had a lot of public support over much later time. And we should remind people, too, that Jack Kevorkian went to jail for some period of time in the state of Michigan for killing another person for homicide. So he may have been well-intentioned, but sort of ham-handed, and that would be an understatement, in the way he went about the cause. And I think in many respects set back the conversation in a pretty significant way. So You're right to sort of point out to his case as a milestone along the way, but maybe not a milestone in moving forward.
So what's different? I mean, because public opinion has clearly evolved on this. How are people thinking of it now than in the days when Dr. Kevorkian was making his, perhaps ham-handed, as you say, case?
The biggest changes, I think, relate to Oregon, as you already pointed out. Oregon and Washington were the first two states in our country with that passed laws that permitted physician aid in dying. And so to just in broad brush here, because there are laws that have specifics, of course, but let me just sort of paint a general picture. The laws permit individuals who are at the end of their life, and that has to be determined by independent physicians, and it's usually a six-month period. So you're terminally ill and you will not live longer than 6 months. You may request, with usually another assessment of your capacity to make that request. So you need to be of sound mind. You need to have time in between the first request and when a prescription is then written. And then a prescription is written and can be filled, but the individual, him or herself, must be the one to then take the dose. So no third party can administer a lethal dose. Right, and so the individual has to be the one to decide it's the time, and then be able to and actually physically take the pills and swallow them. So a number of things have to be possible. You have to be able to swallow pills. You have to be able to pick up pills and put them in your own mouth. Right, you can't be aided by somebody else in that physical process, or that would violate most of the statutes as they are written. So there are numerous steps that have to be met, and there's a strong separation between the individual effectively taking his or her own life or speeding up their death and a third party, whether it's a loved one or a professional, aiding them in that process. So the only thing the professional can do is actually write the prescription.
And isn't that interesting in that the effect of that part of the law may be, in fact, to extend people's lives? Because if you get to the point where you're physically unable to swallow or to take a pill, you and no one else is going to be able to do it for you, you may be able to, stay alive, functionally alive for quite a long time. Whereas if you end your life at that point where you are of sound mind, as they say, and able to make an emotional, intellectual decision about doing it and then physically able to do it, it could happen days, weeks, months before it might otherwise happen.
And to go back to your point about what has changed. So one thing to say is it's about individuals controlling their own destiny, right? So that's to put a point on what you just said. But to answer your question from before about what has changed is we have experience now. The public has experience with what has happened in places where this has been on the books for some time. As you mentioned, Oregon has had law for 20 years. So we know what people have done. And we know that the majority of people who seek the option and have the prescription written and fill it, the majority of those people actually don't take the dose. So they want to have the option and the control, but in the end may not use it. So it isn't about every person who says they want to do this then takes the pills and dies, but rather it gives them a sense of control and comfort and the option to use it if they see it as the only way for them to die the way they choose.
A law to make it legal in Maryland has been bouncing around the Maryland legislature for 4 or 5 years now, I think. Rachel Bay, our Annapolis correspondent, tells us that there's no particular plans to reintroduce it this year. But is this the kind of things that you find people just sort of after a while come to a different conclusion? Is it similar to, same-sex marriage, where everybody was opposed to it until they weren't? Now everybody's for, or, the vast majority of Americans are for it. Is it because, it must be because, at least in some measure, the people have seen what medicine can do to extend life. People can see how much longer people can stay alive yet have a quality of life that's nothing like what they're used to enjoying. I mean, there's so many things that have changed technologically and medically that would tend to move public opinion on this.
Sure. And I think part of the answer to your question is the public will vote with its feet in some respect. When there are places that people can go to seek this option if they so desire it and it isn't available in their own state, maybe they will try to go to a state where it is permitted. So there has to be a demand. And so the question is, at what point do states like ours take this up again? And I think my count is there has been introduced now, a bill has been introduced in Annapolis three different times over the course of, I think you're right, 4 or 5 years, and has not proceeded. So there isn't sufficient sense in the legislature that it's time yet, but that will be something the public can call out for, right? There has to be advocacy. It's one part of the answer to your question. The second is that the demand for options like aid in dying need to be available to people who don't have other good options. And one thing that has really advanced is hospice care. So people who work in hospice will say, we don't need aid in dying legislation because if you do hospice right, people die comfortably. That's what hospice is about. And so rather than giving people options that they don't need, let's invest more in programs that we know work and help people die comfortably. So there's actually a really interesting couple of levels of debate here about which people advocate for which answer to this question. So you have lots of patient advocates generally on the aid in dying side. You have people on the hospice palliative care side of things saying we don't need this kind of legislation, or if we do, it's for very few people. So let's focus on what will actually help the most people who need care at the end of life. And then you have physician groups, not all physicians, but some feel very, very strongly about allowing people to choose this option. Others feel very, very strongly that it's against the goals of medicine, that it violates their professional commitments, and that medicine is about caring for and healing people and isn't about killing people. So it's a very complicated debate that isn't just about sort of when is public opinion right or ripe, or when is the legislature feeling like this is a time for this to go forward.
Senator Ron Young, according to Rachel Bay down in Annapolis, apparently is not particularly optimistic that it will be reintroduced this year after it did not succeed last year. The American Medical Association has, in fact, taken a position on this. What do they think?
They oppose it, and on the grounds that I just briefly outlined, which is that they think it is confusing to patients, it violates the professional norms of medicine, and that I think the third thing would be that there are good professionals in areas of palliative care and hospice that can provide what people need at the ends of their lives. We don't need this, I think, would be the general answer. It's an interesting ethics question, sort of whether healthcare professionals, so let's not limit this to physicians, but healthcare professionals, as part of their professional commitments and the missions of what they do as professionals, is violated by, not just consistent with, but could be deemed as violating whether it's the oath or the way they think about what they do.
The Hippocratic oath.
I mean, there are many different oaths that people take when they graduate from medical school or schools of nursing. Hippocratic is among them. But you sort of are taking an oath to care for people. So one of the arguments is, well, the way you can care most for somebody who's at the end of their life is to help them have an easy death. That is what caring is about. And others will say, well, no, that's killing somebody. That's not caring for somebody. So there's really a kind of fundamental disagreement within the communities of people who care for people who are sick and on their way to dying about what the right answer to this question is, which is why it's been a bit fraught as a matter of the public policy debate.
Before we take a break, explain to folks and to me, because I always get confused about this, is there a particular distinction between palliative care and hospice care? How do you decide the difference?
We should maybe shout out to our professional colleagues in this area who can call in and answer in a way that I'll probably get a little bit wrong, but it will be general what I say. So palliative care is helping people who are in pain, right, have less pain or be pain-free. Hospice is for end of life. They tend to travel together, but they're not the same thing. That's my best sort of 10-second explanation, right, and we'll see whether callers agree.
Fair enough. Well, we're going to take a 90-second break, and we will be back with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. You are welcome to join this conversation about this very complex issue. What do you think about aid to dying, or death with dignity, or what some folks refer to as the right to die? 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780 is where you can call to get in touch with us here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, my guest will be Michelle Singletary. She's an author and Washington Post syndicated columnist who writes The Color of Money, which appears in The Post and more than 100 other newspapers. We'll talk about trends in personal investing, including the fact that there's a growing list of experts who are not very keen on 401ks as a retirement investing tool, and whether or not individual investors should adjust their financial strategy now that Donald Trump has taken office. Michelle Singletary will take your questions and comments about money management. That's coming up on Midday tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about death with dignity laws, or aid in dying laws, and some of the other big issues in the area of bio and medical ethics. We'd love to have you join our conversation. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our telephone number here, 410-662-8780. It's the when we talk about the rhetoric involved in defining this issue, death with dignity, or aid in dying, the one that does pop out to a lot of folks is this whole notion of right to die. It's a loaded term, isn't it, in so many ways?
Yeah, and rights are different than assistance or aid. When we invoke a right, so think of our Bill of Rights in the Constitution. There are two types. One are non-interference rights. So if you have a right to speak, right, freedom of speech is a kind of right. It's a right of the government not to interfere, right? So we don't say the government has to give you the microphone or the podium or the radio program on which to speak, but rather they can't interfere with your speaking out. And then there are entitlement rights. Right to education is about the best we can point to in our society. So what kind of right to die do we have, right? So if I want to end my life and commit suicide, that used to be a criminal offense, not anymore. So we decriminalized people taking their own lives, partly because it doesn't make a ton of sense to try to prosecute somebody who's dead, right? But it also recognizes that people have a liberty right, a non-interference right to take their own life if they so choose. So if that's right, then what do people need in terms of their medical care, their health care, in order to act on that right? They need aid. They need assistance, right? So if we agree that there's a right to die, then it invokes certain kinds of demands on other people to help live that right or realize that right. And so that's why we get into this sort of language.
Rights have to be conferred.
They first have to be conferred, and then if we agree that they are conferred or they're human rights, right? We don't confer them. They're just because we're human and we are born with certain inalienable rights. Maybe this is among them. And if that's the case, then people have an obligation, literally, to help people realize, act on those rights. And that's why we then say, well, someone has to help me if I have a right to do this. I can't do it myself. I can't go to the drugstore and say, give me a lethal dose of barbiturates. Someone has to write a prescription for that. So that's why we get into the policy aspects.
I have a dear friend who passed away from ALS a few years ago, and many of our listeners got to know him. His name is Dudley Clendenin, and he did a series of interviews with me on the morning show over a period of about a year and a half when he was diagnosed, and he realized that he was going to die sooner rather than later for this disease that has no cure. Dudley's a writer, a journalist, a reporter. He had just written a book about his mother's experience at the end of her life and the people that she lived with in this retirement, this stepped care retirement community in Florida. And Dudley began that process when we started having our conversations that we broadcast on the morning show by pointing to the cost of keeping him alive as his functions began to deteriorate. And he made a decision early in the process that said, you know, because it's going to be so expensive to keep me alive, I don't think that that's that it's legitimate for me to incur that kind of cost on behalf of society. Therefore, I want to make sure I'm gone before it becomes so expensive. Interestingly, as you mentioned in the first part of the show, he made a different decision as he got closer to death. And he did not, in fact, invoke anything that speeded up or assisted him in dying. He died naturally. So his mind changed on that over a period of 18 months. But is cost, because we hear all the time that, you know, Medicare is in such trouble because we spend so much money at the very end of people's lives. Should it matter how much money we spend at the end of somebody's life? Is that a determining criteria for thinking about this issue?
Can I react first to your recounting of your conversations with Dudley, which I remember very well and were extremely powerful, and I'm sure many of the people listening today will now be taken back to those. Those are some of the driveway moments on WYPR. I think the short answer to your question is no. It should not be how we think about, you know, whether this is an appropriate thing in policy or not. And that reminds me of the rhetoric that came out of the Affordable Care Act debate and the notion of death panels, right? That somebody is going to make a decision about whether you should live or die based on how much it will cost. And we have never done that. We don't do that. We shouldn't do that. So I think that needs to be sort of out of the conversation. But there needs to be a sense on the part of patients in the healthcare delivery system in which they find themselves that they trust that the decisions about their care are not being made based on, you know, well, it's going to cost too much to keep this person alive for whatever value of life they have left. We have to make sure people don't think that that is what's happening. It isn't. And if we get to a point where that is part of the thinking, then it isn't really about people controlling the ends of their life, but rather trying to play defense against a system that they are worried will not treat them aggressively or to the extent that is possible because somehow that will not be economically a good investment. We don't do that. And so we should really separate those two things in terms of the conversation. I want to say again, and I said it before, but I feel like it's important to say again, that Dudley, like many of us, are sort of high control people, right? We have very particular views about what we want our life to be like. And the thing, among the things that are the most worrisome to us when we get sick and find ourselves in situations where we're less able to control our lives is losing that control. So to the extent that you're given the option to control even the final decisions about when you will die, it's a comfort, even if you don't seek it, right? It's to your point. You can change your mind. And as you get closer, you may say, fine, today's a good day. Today's not a day I want to use that option. But to know that I have it is actually not only a comfort, but may make those days better. And so it isn't so much something to act upon, but rather knowing that it's something that you won't lose control of. And among the most important things that we face, in fact, right, we won't lose control of, which is when our lives will end. We can't control when we're brought into the world, but maybe we can control when we leave this world.
Yeah, that certainly was the case with Dudley. I mean, the notion that he had that option was a source of great comfort to him. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Minna in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn.
Thank you. I was a volunteer in the waiting area serving the intensive care area at the University of Washington Hospital. And my job was to sit there, help the visitors, make the coffee, do anything they needed to make the hour comfortable. But once an hour, they had to call ahead to the room where their loved one was being was sick and ask permission from the nurse there for their 20 minutes to be with that person. The woman who was in charge of the waiting of the operating rooms and the waiting area, with the permission of the hospital administration, changed the entire thing. The families had free access to that room unless something very unusual was taking place. In other words, they could come and go. Immediately, the stress level subsided. My feeling was that we actually had to let some nurses be transferred because they could not accept giving up the control of saying, yes, you can come in, or no, you can't come in to the room. In the end, my feeling was that if the doctor or the nurse was the patient in the bed and they were the one that was in such terrible pain, they would certainly rather have a family member talking to them, holding their hand, being comforted by that, instead of this arbitrary 20 minutes once an hour. And when I moved to Baltimore and tried and called four hospitals to see if there was a volunteer position like the one I had left, I found every hospital I contacted, they were still doing the same old, and that was not sufficient any longer for me. What I had learned in Seattle was not being done here in Baltimore at that time. And so I no longer was a volunteer at any hospital here in Baltimore.
And Minna, when you were doing this volunteer work in Seattle, was this during the time that Washington had passed its aid in dying legislation?
No, not yet.
This was before that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. This was in the before 1982.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thank you for the call, Minna. I appreciate it.
You know, Minna's points are very well taken. The environment of intensive care units are notoriously high-tech, full of lights and beeping machines and people in and out and sort of loss of time, day, night. You sort of can't keep track of what's going on. And as she pointed out, families are not often allowed to visit their loved ones. There's actually a project at Hopkins, so there's a little bit of a shout-out to my colleagues, that Peter Pronovost, who among his duties runs a patient safety program at Johns Hopkins, and my colleague Jeremy Sugarman and Gail Geller worked on a project funded by the Moore Foundation to try to reduce the sort of insensitivity, increase the respect in the way care is delivered in intensive care units. So making the machines less noisy and less flashing, and making, you know, fewer of making them talk to each other rather than beeping constantly, having humans have to come and attend to them, as ways of improving the quality of life effectively in these high intensity delivery of care environments. So I hope it's a little different than what Minna experienced when she first came to Baltimore.
Yeah, it's been, I'm happy to say, a long time since I've been in a hospital, several years, but a hospital is probably the last place you can go to get actually some rest. It's pretty busy. No, they're coming in, they're poking and prodding you in the middle of the night and taking your blood pressure.
And very disorienting for everybody involved.
Nancy has aided our understanding of palliative care. She writes in an email, I'm a palliative care social worker in Baltimore, and she would define palliative care as an extra layer of support for people with serious illness. And this support includes symptom management, disease state education, and goals of care conversations. Those are very important. Palliative care sees the individual as a whole person, so symptom management can include pain, shortness of breath, but also psychosocial, spiritual, or existential distress. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for that that clarification and help with understanding palliative care. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us from time to time to talk about issues in bioethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We've talked about the cost and things like Medicare. I mean, Congress many years ago said there's no way that Medicare is ever going to pay for aid to dying things. There are private insurers who do pay for it, but the cost of actually obtaining these drugs in some instances is fairly prohibitive. I mean, if your insurance doesn't cover it, I mean, where does that stand in the private insurance markets? Do most insurers allow this? Because I understand that there's a drug company who spiked the price, and it could can now cost as much as $4,000 or $6,000 to get the medication you would want to end your life. And so now physicians are scrambling and trying to come up with other cocktails of opioids and barbiturates and whatnot, and trying to work around that. What about the cost to the family, to the individual?
Yeah, so I think it's different depending on the insurer, of course, and it's not clear what will happen in insurance markets as the new administration moves to act on the Affordable Care Act. So it's certainly an issue to take account of, but I would say I don't know that it's any greater an issue in this context than it is in other areas of healthcare, where we know drug prices are, in some respects, you know, astronomical and rising for reasons that don't seem to be rational. And so I think it's not a particular issue in this case, but rather one that shows up here just like it shows up in other areas of medicine as well.
Let's try to grab one more call before we take a break. Steve in Towson, you have an interesting question about life insurance as regards aid in dying. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thanks very much. So I just wanted to know whether people who go through this process, physician-assisted suicide or aid in dying, whether they lose their life, their families lose their life insurance because of that.
That's an interesting question. I have no idea.
It's a great question. So I only know this in my own particular situation, not because I am close to needing to know, but just because I live in this world. And the life insurance that my wife and I have individually would not be lost if we sought that option. So I would say, to my knowledge, policies generally don't deny coverage for cases like this, but I'm not an insurance agent, nor I think could anybody say in every case, you know, it is A or B. So I would say read the policy is the best answer, or talk to the agent who you work with or who sold you the policy to find out the answer to the specifics.
And we'll see maybe. That's a great question, Steve. Thank you for your call. We'll see maybe as aid in dying legislation perhaps becomes in effect in different and in even more states than the current dozen or so that have it. We'll see if that changes, where the insurers are going to change. Louise in Baltimore, let's try to get your question before we take a break. Thanks for calling Midday with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a chaplain, and I have worked hospice many, many years. I do not believe that we have a right to die. I believe that right belongs to God. And there are many, many things, including the things that the social worker mentioned just a few minutes ago, the advanced directives, looking at psychosocial type of issues, looking at family dynamics and all that. That certainly relieves a lot of the pain, because pain is not just physical. It's emotional and it's spiritual and so on. That kind of attention that we can pay to the patient and or his family, her family, makes a whole lot of difference in death. And I've seen a lot of very peaceful deaths.
Well, that's a really great point. I wonder, Louise, I mean, as a chaplain, having these conversations with people when they're in such a difficult and tender moment in their lives, have you ever encountered a situation where a patient has said to you, "I want to die," and you've been in the position to say, "That's not your decision to make; it's God's"?
What I say is that's a normal and natural wishing to have the whole thing over with. People say that. They say that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see what we can do to help make that transition a little bit easier for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your call. Dr. Kahn?
I think that's a perspective that many people share, Louise's perspective. And by the same token, I think there are people who don't share that perspective. And so, like other matters of individuals' bodily control, and we can point to other very controversial social policy debates in our country that are similar, right? Abortion would be one, where thoughtful people can disagree. The question as a matter of policy is whether people should be afforded the option. So people like who hold Louise's view need not take advantage, but that doesn't necessarily preclude us having a policy for people who don't share that view, who may then say, well, I don't believe that it's only God's decision about when I leave this earth. I want control over that. I want the option to do so, and I think I have a right to do so. So that's what the policy debate is over, not whether everybody should have to follow, but rather whether it should be an option afforded to those who choose it.
Well, Louise, I do appreciate your very thoughtful comment. I appreciate everybody who's called 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back in about 90 seconds with more with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about issues in bio and medical ethics, particularly right to die or aid in dying legislation. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go back to the phones. John in Carroll County, welcome to the program, and thanks for your call with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn.
Thank you. Dr. Kahn, how do you feel about, or what are the ethics regarding checking a person's decision who would like to die? Should society have any say in that procedure? And maybe you could answer that. I don't have to hold on. I just thought maybe you might answer that ethical issue for society.
All right. Thank you for your call, John. So are there, you know, you mentioned a couple. I mean, like, you can't just go to the drugstore and, you know, get your own prescription for barbiturates or whatever. Would that be considered a societal check and balance to people who choose to end their life?
It's a good question, and John is right to bring it up. And at the outset of the conversation, we talked about the policies that are in place around the country, all of which share certain features. One of which is the individual needs to be deemed terminally ill, and that's generally within 6 months of their death. Now, that's a hard thing to predict, but medical professionals, usually more than one, have to sign off, check a form effectively saying, yes, this person is within 6 months of their death. And then another assessment is made of the individual. So first is their medical condition. Does it meet certain criteria? Second, is the individual able to make an autonomous and voluntary request? So they're not asked, do you want to die? But rather they have to say, I want to have this option. They're not asked whether they want it. They have to actually seek it out. And then they have to be evaluated about whether that reflects their real thinking. So that's a more a psychiatric or psychological evaluation. There usually is a time window that needs to pass. So you think about it. So you have to ask for it again, effectively. And then only after those criteria have been met can a prescription then be written. So those are the checks that society has placed as a matter of policy between individuals and their seeking aid in dying. And then the others are this sort of bright line between the individual who will prescribe and the individual who will then take the lethal dose. So I think they're like the way the policies have evolved are fairly consistent and represent a good reflective way to think about this. And nobody, I don't think, in any of the assessments of the laws to date is arguing that people are being hurried along the path here. Rather, most people are not using it, but they like having the option available to them. So I think the evaluations have all been quite positive about checks and balances.
Yeah, it looks like the experience in Oregon, for example, it's fewer than 1% of the deaths in Oregon are because people have taken a fatal dose, voluntarily taken a fatal dose of something to end their
life.
So this is really not an option that most people are taking.
No, for sure.
By any means, yeah.
And even of those who seek this as an option, less than half, I don't remember what the last proportion is that I have seen, but maybe it's even a third, actually follow through. So it's 1%, and then there's...
So they get the medication, but then they decide not to take
it. And they leave it in the drawer.
Yeah. Robin in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Dr. Kahn. I hope you can hear me all right. I've been told the connection's not great.
Yeah, you're doing okay right now.
Okay. I'm a doctor, but I'm, like all doctors, ultimately a patient. And I think that we doctors can be sometimes a little bit smug when we talk about not being in the business of killing people. Of course, we're not. But there are situations that are much more nuanced and complicated. For example, we aren't perfect at treating all pain. So sometimes people's pain is not well treated or not adequately treated. And also, people who are profoundly demented, say, for years and years and years, may not have wished to be in that situation. So patients, unfortunately, the gatekeepers to drugs that they may wish to use to end their life, they're prevented from getting them by doctors. And Dr. Kahn, you sort of glanced on that argument for a moment, and I'd like to hear you comment more on that, because I think that's kind of the crux of the matter for many people in our society, that we doctors are put in this a little bit of a false situation of being in between people, patients, and the means to controlling the end of their life by the situation that we hold the prescription pen. So can you talk more about that?
Well, thanks for that call, Robin. Much appreciated. That's a really great point about the issue of dementia, Alzheimer's disease. It's complicated stuff.
Right. So, Robin, I appreciate your call, and you said it as well as I could. I want to say that people who lack capacity to make their own decisions, so people with dementia would fall into that, would not be eligible for aid in dying in any of the policies that have been passed across the United States. So someone would have to decide for them, and we just won't permit that. There are countries in the world that do permit that. So the Netherlands would be the one that people would point to, where that crosses a line between aid in dying and what we would call euthanasia. But to Robin's point, I mean, part of what I hear in the way you articulated it is maybe it's not right to think about this as a medical decision, right? We've medicalized so much of what happens in our lives. Maybe the end-of-life decision isn't one we should be doing in the context of other kinds of healthcare. And people have, I think, more in passing suggested that there ought to be a different kind of profession, that people, it's neither doctors nor nurses nor other healthcare providers, but rather people who are, you know, engaged in helping people die. And that would lead to less confusion or less in the middle, being in the middle, as Robin put it. And I think as we go along this path, as a matter of policy in our country, we will need to find ways for this to work maybe better than it has, because it does put professionals in an extremely awkward position. They want to relieve suffering. That's what we want them to do. But we don't want to put them in a position of being accused of killing people. And so that's the challenge.
And I guess, you know, as you mentioned earlier, people in the hospice care and palliative care profession might say, we're the ones, we're the professionals. On the other hand, a hospice care person isn't in the mix with a person who's living for years and years and years with dementia.
No, and people with dementia fall into a terrible in-between state in many respects of in-between, right? Their personhood has been diminished, and sometimes one would argue is gone altogether. What do we do with people in those situations? It's extraordinarily challenging. I have to say, among the most affecting films I've seen in the last few years is a film called Still Alice.
I love that movie. Moore.
Julianne Moore, who is an academic.
Because you watch the progression of her mental capacity.
As an academic who's a professor of psychology at some elite university. So as an individual who lives that life, what could be worse, right, than losing your capacity to use your brain in the way that has brought you to where you are, and what to do about that, right? So these are extremely challenging kinds of circumstances. I don't know that they're ones best met by the kind of aid in dying policies we're thinking about. They're a different problem. a no less problematic problem, but a different problem.
410-662-8780. I have a few minutes left here on Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Got a few folks on the phone. Yvonne in Baltimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. I am a physician. I've had extensive experience in the ICU, and I find our most vulnerable patients are those that cannot speak for themselves and say what their wishes are. And a lot of times, despite extensive counseling and education to family members who do have the power to say what to do, tend to keep patients alive, and that oftentimes means that they suffer more. And because we have to respect wishes, we have to pursue aggressive care. I find that we tend to harm our patients, and despite our counseling and educating. So I do believe strongly in the right to die.
Not all physicians do. Yvonne is one who does.
So we're talking about a little bit of a different version of this situation, and I appreciate Yvonne's call and her experience. So when an individual is being maintained on mechanical ventilators or other life support, withdrawing that is not the same thing as aid in dying. We separate those. That's removal of medical care, and that doesn't require any new special law. That happens every day, and those are challenging conversations to have. But those are decisions that individuals can make known to their loved ones in advance. As Yvonne was saying, we can't ask people when they're not conscious or when they're lack capacity, because they suffer from certain kinds of dementia. But we can make known, when we're able to do so, what our wishes would be, or more important, who we would want to decide for us when we can't decide for ourselves. Those are called durable powers of attorney for healthcare, sometimes living wills. But durable powers of attorney for healthcare are the right kind of mechanism. So sign a piece of paper that says your spouse, your child, your parent, one person should be the one who decides for you. And when the time comes, they should know what your wishes would be.
Yeah, very important.
That's the most important thing to take away from Yvonne's comment, and among the most important things we can say, I think, today.
Cal in Baltimore, I think we'll have time for one last call. Thanks for calling Midday.
Oh, thank you so much. My question is regarding the mixture of drugs that are given to these patients. I imagine it's quite painless, and how does it work, and is it usually typically painless? And then secondly, I wonder why, if it is, why this isn't used in, let's say, lethal injection, or there's so many debates on whether it's ethical to use a lethal injection. Why don't they just use these types of drugs instead?
Yeah, in terms of capital punishment. Yeah, that's a great question, Cal. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, it'll be a short answer, unfortunately, because I don't know the way the cocktail works. It's not an area that I can speak in as any expertise about. I think the expectation is people will go to sleep and not wake up. Why and what we use in terms of lethal injection is a much more complicated conversation, and one in which I'm not an expert at all. But that the way that is carried out has been a practice that's actually very controversial in the medical profession, and has been sort of stylized over time about why it's done the way it is. And I don't have any insight about what the answer to that is.
Cal, according to the New York Times, the drug of choice seems to be Secanol, the most commonly used aid in dying drug, and it became a politicized thing when the pharmaceutical company that bought the company that owned it, Valeant, hiked up the price from $250 a dose to like $3,000 or $4,000 a dose. So, but that's a really interesting question, and I appreciate the call. Appreciate everybody calling today, and Jeff Kahn, always good to see you. We shall see you next time.
Looking forward to it.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us from time to time to talk about issues in bioethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We've got a link to the Berman Institute on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how to manage your money with personal finance expert Michelle Singletary, a popular author and columnist who writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column called The Color of Money. It appears in the Washington Post and more than 100 other papers. Investing in your kids' education or paying back your student loans, preparing for retirement, making the right kind of financial decisions given your personal financial situation. Michelle Singletary will take your calls, your questions, and your comments tomorrow on midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thanks for hanging with us today. I'm Tom Hall. I'm looking forward to being with you tomorrow. On behalf of the Midday team, have a great day.